From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Pro-government fighters in Yemen report killing a senior al-Qaeda leader along with at least two other militants. Ali Abed al-Rab bin Talab, better known as Abu Anwar, was the head of a court set up by al-Qaeda in Yemen's largest province, which the extremist group largely controls. Yemeni officials said Abu Anwar's convoy was heading to the southern port city of Aden when it was attacked. The Somali militant group al-Shabaab has released a new recruiting video that highlights U.S. police shootings and the call by presidential candidate Donald Trump to ban Muslims from entering the United States. The video released Friday may be the first instance of a U.S.-designated terrorist group using current issues in the United States to attract followers online. Authorities are trying to determine what caused an inferno at a high-rise luxury hotel in downtown Dubai that burned during the city's New Year's Eve fireworks extravaganza. The Address Hotel on fire provided a dramatic real-life scene as thousands of people watching the fireworks display across the street looked on. The hotel is located near the Burj Khalifa, which is the tallest building in the world. VOA's Margaret Bashir, who is spending her holiday in Dubai, said many fire trucks and water tanks were still in front of the hotel on Friday.
Authorities here are saying that the internal parts of the hotel were not gutted by the fire. That I think they had a very advanced sort of sprinkler system that seems to have kept the fire from spreading internally. But the facade is really badly damaged on the north side of the building.
The hotel was evacuated during the fire, but 14 people suffered minor injuries and one person experienced a heart attack. The blaze appeared to be extinguished by Friday. This is VOA News. An explosion struck Afghanistan's capital Friday evening, killing one person, wounding 11 people. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack, saying one of its suicide bombers carried it out and claiming the target was a restaurant frequented by foreigners. The blast hit a residential area of the city, which is home to many Afghan officials and where guest houses are located. A statement sent to VOA in Islamabad by a Taliban spokesman claimed heavy casualties were inflicted, but did not give the number of attackers involved. A manhunt is underway in Tel Aviv after an unidentified gunman killed two and wounded at least three others on a busy street in Israel's second-largest city. Security camera footage aired on Israeli television showed the attacker, who appeared to be in his mid to late 20s and wore protective eyeglasses and windbreaker, browsing at a delicatessen on the street, then pulling a gun from his backpack, stepping back and starting to shoot. Israel has recently transferred the bodies of 23 Palestinians killed in a recent wave of attacks on Israelis back to Palestinian towns and villages in the West Bank in an attempt to ease current tensions in the area. The New York man who was accused of planning to carry out a New Year's Eve attack on behalf of the Islamic State terror group had had psychiatric problems since childhood, according to his family. Federal authorities say 25-year-old Emmanuel Lutchman had been in trouble with the law since 2006 and converted to Islam while serving a prison sentence. Lutchman was charged with attempting to provide material support to IS and planning an attack on a bar in Rochester, New York. A court statement said the defendant, claiming to receive direction from an overseas Islamic State member, planned to commit an armed attack on civilians in the Rochester, New York area. The court records also show Lutchman armed himself with knives, a machete, and ski masks. India's capital began the new year with an experiment designed to try to reduce the city's air pollution. On Friday, cars with odd-numbered license plates were allowed on New Delhi streets on odd-numbered days, and cars with even-number plates are to be allowed on even-number dates. It's a two-week trial to start. It ends January 15th. The skeptics say, however, with schools and offices closed, the capital has yet to get a real idea of exactly how the motorists will adhere to those restrictions. And Natalie Cole, the daughter of jazz legend Nat King Cole, who carved out her own success with R&B hits like Our Love and This Will Be, before intertwining their legacies with the unforgettable signature hit, has died at the age of 65. Here's a sample.
Unforgettable in every way.
That was her voice. Now here comes her father.
And forevermore.
And forevermore.
That's some singing.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. Iraqi troops captured most of the city of Ramadi after a seven-month occupation by the Islamic State, or also known as ISIS. Japan and South Korea reached an agreement on the lingering issue of Korean women held as sex slaves or comfort women by Japan's army during its occupation of Korea from 1910 to 1945. In Afghanistan, with combat forces gone, warlords are asserting their power against the national government of President Ghani. And in the Republican presidential race, in the United States, of course, Donald Trump attacked Hillary Clinton for allegedly, as the Wall Street Journal said, quote, acquiescing, unquote, in her husband's, quote, predations against women, unquote. Well, we'll get to that one in a little bit. But first, let's start with the recapture of Ramadi. Michael, this seems to be significant. I think this is, correct me if I'm wrong, the biggest victory so far after ISIS has taken so much territory in Iraq.
It is the biggest military victory so far. I mean, there have been other smaller victories, taking back land in areas like Tikrit, Sinjar. There have been other advances, ISIS strongholds that have been taken back. But I think this is the most significant in terms of the size, in terms of also who was participating in this. We had Iraqi troops, you had Kurdish troops, you even had some Shia militias who were participating in this. So it's kind of like a coalition of the willing on a much smaller scale doing this. So it's a significant military and sort of a significant political victory in that sense.
Well, is this how big a victory is it? I mean, this is not like D-Day in World War II, but how does it stack up, Tom?
Well, no, it's not D-Day, but it's very significant. This is a big city. This is not just a small provincial town. It's a big city. And the real question is can the Iraqi government hang on to it, and can it put in a civil administration to govern it?
That sounds hard.
Well, it sounds like a tall order, but that I think is the next phase here. I mean, I suspect it'll be easier to hold it, especially with the U.S. And the other coalition members willing to help out on that, especially with the aerial campaign, the bombing campaign. But how you bring order and stability out of the chaos that has been wreaked on the place from by ISIS for months, many months now, is another question. The Iraqi government has got to show it can hold the city, and that's going to be a little more difficult.
And Michael, there's another issue sort of in the background here, at least as I see it, and that is the question of carpet bombing. You know, this heavy bombing of ISIS that has been advocated by Ted Cruz, for instance, a Republican presidential candidate. You know, this argument about how much air power can do has been going on for decades, longer than we've lived.
Yeah.
And how significant can the air power be? Or do you need, as I think, you need ground troops to go and take a place like Ramadi? You can't bomb your way into capturing Ramadi.
Not in this type of action. No, you can't bomb your way in. You can't keep the land with a bomb. As Tom says, the idea here for the long term is for the Iraqi government to hold this thing. So, yes, I think the bombing gives you... It's a tool for gaining ground. It's a tool for allowing a foothold for troops to come in, for other types of forward-looking devices to be put forward. But, carpet bombing in the long term does nothing except destroy things. At some point, you have to build. At some point, you have to have these tens of thousands of displaced people come back in. I think one interesting point is that the U.S. has already pledged $50 million, $50 million with an M, to rebuild this town. It sounds like a drop in the bucket, but if the Iraqi government shows the ability to put something down to start to rebuild and have something that replaces either ISIS or Al-Qaeda or whatever insurgent movement comes along, then certainly more money and more support is to come.
I think the other thing that may be significant about this, Fred, is that everybody knows there is American involvement here, not heavy duty ground forces, but a little special forces, certainly some forward air controllers. But the Iraqis wanted to try to make a statement that they could do this without American support. And so so we will see. It's interesting to me that some Pentagon generals are saying that the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is probably going to ask for more American troops.
Really?
Yep.
What sort of numbers are being tossed around?
5,000, mm-hmm. 8,000. It'll be interesting to see how President Obama reacts to that.
Would these be combat troops, or would they be in combat units with the with Iraqi forces?
A little of both, but mm-hmm. the Pentagon, senior leadership of the Pentagon, believes that you can't just have 1,500 special forces or 2,000 forward artillery, forward observers. You've got to have some mm-hmm. tactical combat mm-hmm. forces, even though they might be small. And I think mm-hmm. President Obama has signaled his reluctance on that. So we'll have to, that's going to be one of the early decisions at the Pentagon and the White House next year.
Next year's right upon us. It's it's this year.
He's going to have to decide something before the State of the Union address, which is usually at the end of January.
Mm-hmm. What about that, Michael? This is an interesting dilemma for President Obama. He probably doesn't want to do it, but that doesn't mean he won't.
It doesn't mean that he won't. I think, as an outgoing president, he has different political fish to fry than mm-hmm. other people. It's more about legacy than elections for him.
Yeah.
Troops on the ground certainly is what's going to make it happen. Yeah. If he wants to try to win the presidency for Hillary, he'll probably wait until that incoming president puts, and not presuming that she's going to win.
Right.
If he wants her to get a boost in that mm-hmm. Election process, to wait for the next president to make that decision about putting significant mm-hmm. troops on the ground.
Well, certainly he does want a Democrat to follow him in office for a whole number of reasons that I'm not going into at the moment, because we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Michael Williams and Tom DeFrank. Let's turn to Japan and South Korea. And a lingering issue, as I said in the introduction, lingering. I didn't say it was what it was lingering from. It's been lingering from World War II and even earlier, this question of the comfort women, Korean women, taken by the Japanese Army and used basically as sex slaves. The comfort women is, there's a euphemism for you, right?
Right.
Anyway, the Japanese had apologized before, but somehow that didn't seem to be significant enough for the South Korean government, and now they have a new agreement, and what is missing is one thing. And despite this agreement, there are no reparations, and there are some, I think there's something of, 40-some of these women still alive, most of them not married, most of them not had never talked about what they experienced publicly. And is this thing really going to be the end of this issue or not, Tom?
Well, it's hard to know, Fred. I mean, I think there is a modest amount of restitution being talked about. I think
it's something like $8 million.
$8 million mm-hmm. U.S. dollars, which is pretty piddling, to put it mildly. I mean, everybody knows that the Japanese have been extremely, for cultural reasons, I think, the Japanese have been notoriously reluctant to fess up in other respects. Japanese Prime Minister Abe has been especially reluctant, mm-hmm. but I think he has, with some serious prodding by the U.S. government, I believe this is a step forward. I don't think it will ever completely wipe out the problem, but as you said, it's we're not talking about a large universe of comfort women mm-hmm. still alive. Dozens die every month, mm-hmm. So I think this will always linger. The Japanese will always be grudging about this sort of thing, but it is a positive development. The real question is going to be, does the South Korean government think this is enough?
Mm-hmm. Well, they agreed to this, but that doesn't necessarily mean they won't want more later. Michael, behind this, of course, is the effort by the U.S. and others in Asia to sort of unite South Korea, you know, Australia, Japan, and so on, but particularly South Korea and Japan, to sort of stand against the Chinese, any Chinese expansion.
This is exactly the point why this is significant for the United States. It's all about the projection of power, you know, through this century in the Asia-Pacific region. And in order for us to do that effectively against China, our allies, the U.S. allies, have to play nicely. And this is a subject, you know, it's been lingering for 70 years, but it can't be underestimated. I lived in Hong Kong. I lived in the Asia-Pacific region. And this issue defines the Japanese for many, many, many Asians. And we're talking about just the South Korean comfort women. I believe there are 46 who are left alive.
Okay.
And this amount of money is not going directly to them. I think it's significant to note that no one's going to get a cash payment. This is being paid to a South Korean foundation, which is in turn going to deliver quote-unquote services to these women for the rest of their lives, which isn't going to be for long.
Right.
I think that the Japanese have never, ever taken legal responsibility.
Not in this either.
Yeah. They consider that the 1965 treaty addressed this once and for all. The bow has gotten more or less deeper on the apology over the years. There was one in 1993 that was kind of accepted. Look, it'll never be accepted, but this is a practical good step because, as you say, Prime Minister Abe and President Park are both rather nationalistic.
Yeah.
Abe to the point of being almost revisionist. So it's kind of like a Nixon goes to China thing about this thing. The deal that these two could accept is a deal that almost no one else could accept who's electable in those two governments. Sure, there will be people who don't accept it, but in some ways that's how you know it's a good deal. Because not all sides agree.
Okay, I think that's enough for that issue. Let's go to Afghanistan, which continues to be troubling. The NATO combat forces are gone. Of course, there's still Americans there and so on, and the warlords are asserting themselves. And the story of the past week was about a warlord beheading some ISIS terrorists who had supposedly beheaded some followers of this warlord. That's not a step that it makes you feel happy about Afghanistan, Tom.
Well, I mean, we have talked about this for years, Fred, from these microphones. The Soviets couldn't solve the military riddle of Afghanistan. The British, twice in the 19th century, suffered horrendous defeats. And at that point, Great Britain was the world's superpower of the time. And the U.S. has not had smooth sailing in Afghanistan either, to put it mildly. I just think Afghanistan is going to be a bigger problem going forward than Iraq and maybe even Iran. Who knows? It does not inspire a lot of confidence, especially in Capitol Hill. And I think that's another reason why Capitol Hill's got to appropriate the money to pay for these sorts of things. And I think that's another reason why President Obama is really reluctant to expand the footprint in Afghanistan beyond the 9,800 troops who are there. Who are there at the moment. As a practical matter, I think he would be more amenable to adding troops in the fight against ISIL in Iraq and even Syria, perhaps, than in Afghanistan. So it's you're right. It's not exactly a Marquess of Queensbury rules in Afghanistan, but it's never been the case. It seems like we always discover these things later rather than sooner.
Yeah, no, I think there needs to be a bigger American military footprint there, but Michael, I find very few people who agree with me.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be going back to the edges, as Tom rightly says. Afghanistan is the place where the world comes to stub its toe.
Yeah,
it's just not a tractable piece of land or tractable culture to get to. I think what makes it important for us to be there, though, and what makes your argument is that politically, Afghanistan is becoming less and less discernible from Pakistan.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with Pakistan in a very open and obvious way. Clearly, the Pakistani government is dealing with the Al-Qaeda presence there. You have to deal with Pakistan, so therefore you must deal with Afghanistan. Neither one is an easy haul.
Well, it certainly, Tom, as you said, politically, I mean, look at the Republican presidential candidates for a moment, and most of whom are very hawkish, but I don't hear them talk about Afghanistan at all.
They don't. A vast majority of the American people, regardless of their political party affiliation, do not want to get dragged into another land war in Asia. I mean, Vietnam is a generation ago, but it feels like not that long ago, and I just think there's a lot of Vietnam overhang here. It's just, and I think President Obama understands that, and it's just going to be a tough haul. The one thing the American people will not tolerate is large numbers of American casualties.
I think maybe even small numbers.
Well, I mean, I think when six Americans died a couple of weeks ago in a yet another suicide bombing attack by a suicide bomber on a bicycle or a motorcycle, this was very jarring. One of the victims was buried just a couple of days ago, and so you're right. That was six, but since casualties have come down, if you have some event where 20 or 30 or 40 die, I think it's going to be a terrible tragedy, but it's also going to be make it even harder for President Obama and Congress to do what some think needs to be done.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
All right. Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Michael Williams and Tom DeFrank, and we've gotten to the issue of Donald Trump, who will say things in a presidential race that nobody's ever said before and may never say again, but has come into combat with the Clintons. Now, the Clintons are Democrats. Hillary Clinton, the wife of former President Bill Clinton, is the favorite to win the Democratic nomination, but Trump is running in the Republican presidential race. But Hillary Clinton has said her husband will play a role in the campaign for her, and that one of her issues is that Republicans are waging a war on women. Well, Donald Trump's response has been, wait a minute, the war on women is something that was carried out by your husband. And, of course, he's been accused of harassment and assaulting women, a number of whom have gone public and over the years and are still. You see him on television.
I think the phrase is often serial philandering.
Yeah, serial philandering.
Alleged serial philandering.
Well, you know, even as I'm talking right now, I can look at some TV monitors, and there's Donald Trump talking on this issue. Sure. Sounds not on, but I know what he's saying. Anyway, Tom, what do you make of this issue? And I think this is a tough issue for Hillary Clinton, now that what Trump has injected led to a strong editorial in the Wall Street Journal and so on.
Well, the Journal doesn't like her much, but still, I agree that this is a problem for her. At the very least, she will have to address questions at the next Democratic debate, because now the debate moderators have a legitimate reason to ask her what about this. And I think it's going to be a problem for her. I think what Trump is really doing very skillfully is shoring up his base of voters. Most of his voters, I think, are white, older, middle class, and they hate the Clintons. Mm-hmm. And they it's not just politics, it's cultural as well. Mm-hmm. These are people who feel like that they've been left out of the system. But I think this is the sort of red meat that absolutely appeals to Trump supporters, and also a lot of conservatives who probably don't think that Trump should be the next president of the United States. Mm-hmm. So I think at some point, this is the kind of thing that will help Trump a lot in the primaries and caucuses, but it's not a good general election issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think this issue, though, Trump does these things. It is a tough issue for Hillary Clinton, though. And the question of her husband and whether she acquiesced, as that's the word the Wall Street Journal used anyway, acquiesced in her husband's whatever he did with these other women. It's an issue that the press will have to ask about at the next debate. And I'm not sure how Hillary can deal with that. Should she stop talking about a war on women by Republicans, Michael?
No, I don't think she's going to do that, because she has to do that to effectively talk to her base. So she's not going to forego her base just to stay out of some sort of one-on-one debate with Donald Trump. What's fascinating to me is that Donald Trump has managed to somehow position himself as the presumptive Republican nominee by engaging with the presumptive Democratic nominee. And I think Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio would have something to say about that.
Well, she's been doing that too.
She has, because, and there's a good reason for that, because they are very good chess players, these Clintons. Who would she rather face? I believe, of course, she would rather face Donald Trump than any of the others. Marco Rubio in CNN polling is still the only Republican candidate she loses to in a general election, of course, this far out, with the no votes having been placed. But, you know, clearly she's a little more enthusiastic about facing Donald Trump. And I think it really gets interesting if Trump doesn't win the nomination. Mm-hmm. I think 100% chance we're seeing him in November regardless. If he doesn't win the nomination, he comes in as an independent. And boy, without any party reins, wouldn't it be interesting to see what he does? You sort of get this symmetry now where you may have a repeat of 1992 where a outspoken billionaire named Ross Perot enabled Bill Clinton to take the White House by stealing votes from Bush 41.
I think you're right about a continuing role for Donald Trump no matter what. I don't think he has to run as an independent because he'll still be sounding off anyway, and the press is drawn to him so much, even if he's not a candidate in the race.
The truth is Donald Trump loves the attention. He is an egomaniac, to put it mildly. I mean, not an unusual situation for politicians. But he'll be around. He's not going away. I think he will be a broker at the Republican convention, even if he's not the nominee. And he will be popping off in the fall. I think you're right. But if I agree with Michael and you, Fred. I think if he runs as an independent, I think that's going to be very good news for Hillary Clinton.
Well, I tend to agree that he can't beat Hillary Clinton. I mean, look, polls now don't tell us much. But they tell us something. And you cited the poll, Michael, the CNN poll showing that Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, is the only Republican now running ahead of Hillary. Mm-hmm. I think that there are reasons for that. He doesn't have the kind of negative feelings about him around the country, even among some Republicans, as Trump does. And there's a good reason why Hillary wants to run against Trump.
That's true. And I think, you know, when they do these polls, they're polling Republicans about Republican candidates.
Indeed.
And when Donald Trump talks this way about Hillary Clinton, he's going after a vote that we call independent now. But that's really sort of political speak for conservative Democrats. Mm-hmm. And these are, to take an example, Democrats outside of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, outside of the Washington, D.C. area in Virginia. These are the votes that he could possibly steal away to make an election close. And he knows that. And he knows that those votes are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So it's just very interesting to see how he talks about it, because he's not a politician and he's not restricted by typical political speech. He doesn't have to be nice.
Yeah, no, he knows how to do television, though.
Yeah,
that's for
he sure does.
Yeah. Question about that. Tom, does I saw on TV somebody, a Hillary supporter, responding to this and saying, whoa, Bill Clinton's the most popular man around the world, and he is popular. No question about that. That didn't seem to deal with this particular issue. What does Hillary Clinton have a good response to Trump, or does she ignore Trump, or at least try to?
It's going to be hard for her. I don't know if it's successful, but I don't know how much else she can say other than the fact I'm running for president, not my husband. Of course, if you look at the paraphrasing Hillary, if you look at his record, he did this, he that. He's the last president to leave office with a balanced budget. She'll talk about all of that. Mm-hmm. She can't go the vast right-wing conspiracy route that she has gone before, but I don't think she can say much about this. The other thing I would just want to say in passing about Trump, I've often referred to what I call the killer bees. He's a blowhard, he's a bully, he's a billionaire, but... Right. He's not a buffoon.
Yeah.
He's a very smart, far more politically savvy probably than most political experts thought.
Absolutely.
And there's a reason why he's doing this, and I think it's considered. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably good politics for the primaries, but not for the general.
I think that was your point, too, Michael, about Trump. He is an amazing figure, and to see the way he just gobbles up the television and the print attention. I've never seen anything like it. A guy that I don't know whether most people believe he can be elected president. Maybe some do. I certainly don't. But and nothing seems to hold him back.
No.
From dominating the media in a way I've never seen a presidential candidate who hasn't even won a primary or caucus does.
Yeah, he is great television. Yeah. He says he drives sales, circulation, ratings. And it's not really a fair fight. He's going against politicians. The equal and opposite to Donald Trump is not in the race. That'd be Michael Bloomberg. If you had that billionaire on the other side, then you'd have a clash of the titans.
Then you would. Anyway, that's all the time.
Michael.
That's all the time we have. We can't go into this clash of titans at the moment. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Michael Williams of CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Greg Burns. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.